The following program is a production of Sight into Sound Radio. Hello, and welcome to the fifth reading of The Sound of Her Voice by Mary Harper. I'm Debbie Robertson. For those of you who did not hear the last reading of this book, let me bring you up to date. In chapters 11 through 15, the friendship between Jane and Mario blossoms, thanks to the lessening of restrictions about contact between the boys and girls at the school. Blossoming, too, are their academic paths, as both are eager students, ever tenacious and industrious. Now we continue with The Sound of Her Voice. Chapter 16, Lighting Up. Since girls were not expected to make a living, they were not taught a trade. Girls were also not taught mobility. It was assumed they would stay at home. Only the boys learned how to walk with a cane and go out on their own. Instead, the teenage girls learned housekeeping skills, including rudimentary classes in cooking. At age 16, Jane was excited to finally get into the classroom kitchen. Her mother had always prohibited her from the family kitchen, afraid she would hurt herself, but Jane was confident that she could learn to cook. She had to learn if she ever wanted to be independent. She knew that she didn't want to spend the rest of her life sitting at home on the farm. Instead, Jane was determined to live her own life and had begun to dream of a life with Mario. How exciting it would be for her to cook dinners for him every night. Cooking class began with learning to use a gas stove. Divided into groups of threes, the girls gathered at the stove in the home economics laboratory. They were allowed to touch every part of the stove. The girls learned where the knobs were located, reached inside the oven to feel how big it was, and examined the four burners. The teacher demonstrated how to light a burner, turn a knob, listen for the whoosh of the gas, light a match, and finally touch it to the gas. The girls with some vision tried first, with varying success. Jane was not anxious to try her luck lighting the stove. Fire scared her, and with no vision, she was afraid of burning herself. Just lighting the match was frightening, but after three attempts, she managed to produce a flame. Her hand trembling, she hesitantly moved the match toward the burner. The whooshing sound of gas changed as it exploded into fire, startling Jane. She jerked her hand, dropping the match into the flames and jumping back from the stove. "Jane, you did it on your first try," said the teacher. "That's very good." "Thank you, but it's still scary," Jane said as she tried to stop shaking. "I wish that we had an electric stove. I read about them in Good Housekeeping magazine. They sound so much better than gas." "Yes, electric stoves will be good for you girls. You won't have to worry about open flames and lighting matches. Most people still have gas stoves, especially in the country. Many of those houses are just now getting electricity, so it'll be a few years before you'll get an electric stove out on the farms. You better get used to cooking with gas if you want to cook." Jane wasn't comforted by the teacher's words. She knew that even though her parents' house would soon have electricity, her pop wouldn't spend the money to buy a new electric stove. Even if he did buy one, Mother wouldn't allow her to use it. "Someday, when I'm married," she thought, "I'll have my own electric stove and cook whenever I want." Jane learned how to read and follow recipes from Braille cookbooks. She memorized the graduated sizes of measuring cups and spoons. Soon she was able to quickly identify each just by touch. The teacher showed Jane how to hold a knife to chop vegetables, but Jane worried about slicing her fingers instead of carrots. She decided that once she had her own kitchen, she would not use knives. She would buy already chopped, canned, or frozen vegetables and fruits. She'd use kitchen scissors to cut up meat. She felt much more confident with the scissors and wouldn't have to worry about cutting herself. Girls also learned to sew. Some wanted to make their own clothes, but Jane wasn't interested in such a difficult project. She learned to sew on buttons and mend rips, which were skills she would use for the rest of her life. She used a metal threader to thread the needle, but that was the easy part. The hard part was finding someone to help her match the color of thread to the clothing that needed mending. If nobody was around, she used white thread or waited until she asked a sighted person for the right color. It was a constant reminder and frustration that she had to depend upon others to do things that sighted people took for granted. She mastered simple sewing repairs. Jane learned how to crochet. She quickly mastered the hook and enjoyed making a scarf. As an adult, Jane made many afghans, dish rags, pillow covers, and baby blankets for her children and grandchildren. She knew what colors she wanted to use in each project, but of course couldn't shop alone for yarn. Music stirred Mario's soul. At home, he listened to classical music on the radio, spending hours listening to Bach and Beethoven. Teachers at school played records to teach music appreciation. Mario looked forward to those classes with great anticipation. Along with learning to play the piano and the violin, Mario was required to master reading Braille music. After understanding the notes and the meaning of musical notation, such as a whole note, a half note, sharps, and flats, he needed to memorize each measure. He studied a measure, then played it. He repeated the process for each measure. It was hard work for him, and Mario wished that he could learn as quickly as some of his more musically inclined classmates. Although he never felt confident playing the violin, Mario joined the orchestra and was assigned the first violin position. He was also asked to join a piano quartet with three other boys, making for eight hands and two pianos. They memorized March Militaire by Schubert, and they played at a school recital. The following year, they played an adaptation of Tchaikovsky's 1812 overture at a school recital. Mario was saddened that his parents were unable to attend his recitals. Antonio worked 12-hour days at the shop, and Aletta was uncomfortable traveling alone on the interurban from Muncie. While playing with friends was fun, performing a solo was another matter. Mario was terrified of playing alone before an audience. What if he made a mistake, forgot the music? If others were playing with him, he felt less pressure, and sometimes mistakes could be covered. Mario vowed that when he graduated, he would never play a solo again. He was a perfectionist, never playing well enough to be satisfied, yet unwilling to make the extra effort to get better. It wasn't his passion. He knew that he couldn't make a living playing music. Some blind pianists played in bars, but the thought of trying to entertain rowdy drinkers caused him to shudder. His brother Charlie was already in college and talking about studying law at Notre Dame. Mario decided that he would also study law. He knew that practicing law was his only chance to earn enough money to someday marry Jane. Chapter 17, Ball State Teachers College. When Mario was a senior in high school, he was already 20 years old and had been thinking for a long time about how he would earn a living. Staying at home with his parents for the rest of his life was not an option. He was in love with Jane, and he had to find a way to support her. He wanted to get married and have a family and a career. He wanted to be like everyone else in pursuit of the American dream. The school provided opportunities to learn a craft, such as caning chairs and making brooms, but the administration followed society's expectations that blind people generally could not make a living on their own. Although Mario's brother was no longer living at home, the brothers remained extraordinarily close. Charles had attended Ball State Teachers College, now Ball State University, in Muncie for 3 years. Since a college degree wasn't required then for admission, he enrolled at Notre Dame Law School in the fall of 1933. Mario had idolized Charles since early childhood and decided to follow in his footsteps. He, too, would go to Ball State and then on to Notre Dame. He dreamed of practicing law with Charles in Muncie, earning enough money to get married. On a Sunday morning in early 1933, Mario sat with his parents at their kitchen table. He had attended the 8 a.m. Mass, and they were enjoying a hearty breakfast, of Italian sausage and eggs. Mario would be leaving later that morning for Indianapolis, but first he had something to tell them. "Dad? Mom? I need to talk to you about my future," he said solemnly. "I want to go to Ball State next year. You know how important my education is to me and how much I love to learn." "Yes, son, we know," answered Antonio. "We've thought about your future a lot. But I don't have any money, and I'll need help for paying for school, and I'd have to live with you." "You can live with us," Aletta said. "I'd love to have you home again." She thought about how happy she'd be to cook Mario's favorite foods. "We knew that that time would come when you would want to go to college. We've been putting money aside, and there's enough to pay for your tuition," added Antonio. Mario brightened, smiling broadly. He was happy and relieved to have both financial and emotional support from his parents. Attending college would be challenging enough without adding money pressures. "Thank you, Dad and Mom. I can't wait to eat your wonderful cooking every day." "What about Jane? What will she do after high school?" asked Aletta. "She wants to continue her education at Ball State, too. Virginia, Charles' girlfriend, has already said that Jane can live with her. You know that Virginia lives just down Madison Street. We can all take the bus from here out to the college." "It sounds as though you've figured everything out already. College won't be easy for you, but I know that you can do it," said Antonio. "It's almost time to walk down to the inner urban station. Would you like some company?" Senior year passed quickly. With graduation approaching, Mario needed help buying a present for Jane. He had no idea what a suitable gift would be for his beloved. In 1934, only engaged couples exchanged personal items, such as jewelry or clothing. He wanted something special for Jane, but females mystified him. He decided to ask Charles' girlfriend, Virginia Pike, for help, and typed her the following letter. Indianapolis, Indiana, May 21st, 1934. "Dear Virginia, surprised? Well, you guessed it. Won't you please do me a great big favor? There should be a $5 bill in here, which I'd like to have you spend for me. I hardly know what would be appropriate for the occasion, but that is what your brains are for. You see, Jane is graduating this year, and I want to get something for her. Anything but jewelry and clothes, because we can't be engaged yet. I bet you had a swell time over in the East. I wouldn't mind going into those parts myself. It was mighty thoughtful of you to send me that card, all except the ham sandwich part of it, because I was really hungry at the time. Do you know when Charles' school is out? I'm sure we both wish you could get here for the commencement somehow. Jane and I are planning a big private party that night, and we'd like to have you with us. Just the four of us, you know, like old times. Remember, I have $10, a gift of the state, to spend. Well, don't forget to invest that $5 for me, and heaven bless you for it. So long, Mario." Mario mentioned including $5 in the letter for Virginia to purchase something suitable for Jane. $5 in the middle of the Great Depression was a generous amount. $5 in 2022 would be worth about $106. Likewise, the state of Indiana's gift of $10 would be worth $211. Mario was extremely frugal, and it was highly unlikely that he would spend the entire $10 on a graduation party, although they no doubt had a very special dinner out. Before he could celebrate, though, he had a final obstacle to overcome at the School for the Blind. He was summoned to the superintendent's office in early May and was informed that he had been elected valedictorian of his class. "Mario, congratulations! It's a big achievement, and we're proud of you. As you know, the honor involves preparing a speech on a topic of your choice for commencement," said the superintendent. "It should be no more than 10 minutes long, and it must be memorized. You may not use note cards." "Yes, sir," he replied, his heart already racing at the thought of memorizing and giving a speech in front of so many people. While pleased to win the honor, he was terrified of public speaking. What subject should he choose? How would he ever memorize it? What if he forgot the words? With only a few short weeks until graduation, Mario had little time to decide on a topic, then research and write the speech. He thought about his father's immigration as a boy of 12, traveling across the ocean to a new country with a neighbor, not even his parents. His mother came years later as a new bride, and although that must have been difficult, at least she'd been an adult. Immigration had played a very important role in his extended family, with several uncles and cousins having arrived in the States. He decided to speak on the history of immigration and began researching his subject. At commencement, the packed auditorium resonated with the excited voices of the graduates and their proud families. It was a hot June afternoon in 1934. During the Great Depression, the future was uncertain for everyone, both students and their parents. The economy had collapsed, and there were few jobs for anyone, much less young blind students. But that didn't diminish the joy of accomplishment for the students. As valedictorian, Mario sat on the stage waiting for his turn at the podium. He wished that he had his note cards with him, though he had already memorized his speech. He could be going over his speech while listening to his classmate perform Clair de Lune on the piano. He felt sweat dripping down his face and wiped it away with the back of his hand. The music stopped, and he heard the superintendent introduce him. He stood at the podium, cleared his throat, and began speaking the words he'd worked so hard to memorize. "My parents are part of the history of immigration in the United States." 9 minutes later, he was finished with a sigh of relief. He heard the clapping swell as the crowd rose to its feet and allowed himself a smile, acknowledging the applause. The ovation gave him some confidence, but it wasn't until a speech class in college that he was able to overcome his fear of public speaking. Jane and Mario were the only students from their 1934 class of 12 students who continued to college. The rest went back to their homes. If the students lived near a larger town with resources for the handicapped, they went to work in a sheltered workshop. Others in more rural areas were forced to live at home and were dependent upon family for their survival. In the 1930s, most women were not in the paid workforce. They were expected to be homemakers and raise children. Jane knew that she'd never work outside the home and didn't need a degree, but she wanted to continue her education. When Mario told her about his plans to attend Ball State Teachers College in his hometown of Muncie, she seriously considered attending classes with him. Virginia, Charles's steady girlfriend, was also a student at Ball State. When she invited Jane to room with her and her father, Jane jumped at the chance. Instead of sitting and doing nothing at home with her parents, she would be living on her own and seeing Mario daily. Classes at Ball State began in September 1934. Every day, Jane and Virginia rode a city bus to Mario's stop, where Mario waited for them. He lived with his parents, only about 2 miles away from Jane and Virginia. When the three arrived at the campus, Virginia bade farewell and went to her classes. Mario and Jane walked arm in arm to their first class. Jane did not use a cane, nor did she ever want to have one. She felt incapable of walking alone and much preferred a companion to guide her. Since childhood, Mario was fearless and often walked alone. On campus, he held a cane, but only to identify him as blind to others. He didn't swing it back and forth. That was unnecessary. He knew every bump on the sidewalks and how to find each building on the campus. To orient himself, he listened for echoes of buildings or trees. He didn't worry about crossing streets, as there was little traffic on campus. Automobiles were noisy and easy for him to hear as they approached. Mario also became so acclimated to the campus that he developed a clear mental map that enabled him to go wherever he wanted. Yet he couldn't let his mind wander while walking. He needed his wits to concentrate on his route, or risk getting lost. Mario was glad to have Jane as a classmate. Even better, they were finally beyond the scrutiny of the School for the Blind governesses. They could talk whenever they wanted and enjoyed long discussions about their studies while relaxing over coffee at a local cafe. What a delicious feeling to hold her hand freely without getting into trouble with a governess. As the only blind students on campus, Mario and Jane found it hard to make friends at first. Mario couldn't catch someone's eye to make contact. Someone would have to approach him, and it seemed that most people didn't know how to talk to a blind man. He was glad to have Jane's company, but longed to have male friends to discuss other classes and sports. Charles was studying law at Notre Dame, and Mario had become a big fan of the Fighting Irish football team. Jane listened politely while Mario told her about team statistics and exulted in their wins, but he missed having an equally enthusiastic partner to discuss the intricacies of Notre Dame football. Since Jane didn't want to earn a degree, she took classes that interested her or would be of practical value. Mario was in both of her classes in the first quarter. They took Principles of Geography and Ancient World History. Mario loved geography and got an A, while Jane was happy with a B. Subsequently, she enjoyed additional history and typing classes. She liked typing letters to her sisters and also typed all of her academic papers. One of the hardest things about school was keeping up with the reading assignments. Virginia was paid by Ball State to read to Jane, but Virginia had her own reading to do, so Jane had to wait until Virginia had time. Reading aloud took longer than reading a book by sight. Jane would have preferred to do her own reading, but there were no Braille textbooks yet, and tape recordings were decades away. Mario, not personally knowing a reader, searched for one at the college employment office. He qualified for 10 hours a week of readers. There were some federal rehabilitation funds available, so he didn't have to personally pay for their services. Many students applied for the 35 cents an hour job, and Mario was allowed to pick the person who suited him best. Jane and Mario took class notes in Braille, although it was hard to keep up with the professor. They used a slate and stylus with special heavy paper inserted into the slate. Each letter had to be punched at least once. A is one dot, and sometimes up to six punches per letter. Mario was proficient at making notes in Braille, but he would still be punching dots while the professor moved on to the next topic. On days when he had a test, Mario lugged his heavy print typewriter to class. In one of his classes, the professor noticed, as the quarter wore on, an unusual number of students were getting A's. Some of his classmates had figured out that by listening to the taps of his typewriter, they could determine which answers were true and which were false. They copied his answers and got an A. Jane successfully finished 2 years at Ball State, but in 1937, Virginia married Charles and moved to South Bend. With no place to stay in Muncie, Jane went back to the family farm. Meanwhile, Mario stayed at Ball State for 3 more years, and because law schools did not require a college degree in 1937, Mario applied and was accepted to the University of Notre Dame Law School. He was the first blind student to be accepted at the prestigious school. Charles had already graduated from Notre Dame in 1936 and opened a practice in South Bend, Indiana. Mario was ready to follow in his footsteps. After relishing her freedom, adjusting to life at home was difficult for Jane. Her sisters no longer lived at home. Irma was married, teaching school, and living on a farm about 20 miles away, while Ruth attended beauty school in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Jane missed her sisters. It was lonely on the farm with just her parents and no one her age. Although Jane had received cooking lessons at school and was now 24 years old, Bessie still banned her from the kitchen. Every time she asked to practice her skills, her mother said, "No, the kitchen is just too dangerous for you." She was allowed to make her bed and tidy her room, but Bessie was fearful that she'd break something and told her not to dust or clean the rest of the house. Frustrated, Jane spent hours reading Braille books. She subscribed to several magazines as Good Housekeeping and Reader's Digest. Jane especially enjoyed the short stories and articles about current events. She also had a new talking book record player, which played recordings of people reading popular books. Jane listened to many books that she didn't have time to read in high school, including the classics by Charlotte Bronte and Jane Austen. Reading helped pass the endless hours on the farm. Irma and Ruth helped to break the tedium with occasional weekend visits home. Jane relished escaping the solitude of the farm, especially when her sisters drove her into Wabash, where they enjoyed shopping and trying on the latest fashions. On Sundays, Irma and Ruth went to church with Jane and their parents. Then they all enjoyed a full Sunday dinner. It was hard for Jane when they left to resume their lives. She missed their laughter and stories. The house felt too quiet and accented her loneliness. While neighbors stopped by to chat about farm prices or to exchange local gossip, Jane had no friends of her own. She was isolated both by the farm life and her disability. Her only consistent link with the outside world was her parents' new radio, which used the newly installed electricity in the house. Rural Indiana didn't have electricity until the late 1930s, and both electric lights and the radio were novel and exciting. Bessie no longer worried about Jane accidentally knocking over a burning kerosene lantern. Every evening, the family sat under the bright lights of two electric lamps and listened to the news, to music, and to comedy shows. The radio provided an important connection to the world, and although Jane was still lonely, she could at least hear about the outside world and enjoy the music. Letters remained her only way to communicate with Mario during his last year at Ball State, as the family still did not have a telephone. She read each letter multiple times, memorizing his words and trying to visualize his experiences. She missed their daily conversations from their Ball State days together and longed to hear his voice. Although Mario was only about 50 miles away, it seemed like 1,000 miles. If bus or train service had been available, Mario undoubtedly would have been eagerly traveling alone to the farm. But he was forced to wait until it was convenient for Charles and Virginia to drive him to the farm for a Sunday afternoon visit twice each summer. Chapter 18. Hanging Rock. Just before noon, on a hot, hazy July Sunday, Jane heard the familiar rumble of Charles's old jalopy as it swayed over the rough gravel road. She leapt from the porch rocking chair and walked to the driveway, smiling in anticipation of a loving hug from Mario. The couple spent a few minutes visiting with Bessie and Charles before heading out for a picnic at their favorite place, Hanging Rock. Only a few miles from the farm, Hanging Rock towered almost 70 feet above the Wabash River, appearing to hang over the river. Formed when the river undercut the base, the limestone rock had been used as a lookout post for Native Americans. "Mario, if you'll carry the picnic basket, I'll take the blanket," said Charles, handing the heavy wicker basket to his brother. "Sure, I'll carry it. Virginia, are you walking with Jane?" Mario asked as he took Charles's elbow to begin the hike up to the rock. "Yes, we'll follow you up. It's harder for us ladies to climb in dresses, but you boys go ahead and get a good spot," answered Virginia. There were no steps, just a steep dirt trail littered with rocks and tree roots that seemed to lie in wait for Virginia and Jane to trip over. It was a warm day. Both couples were sweating and out of breath when they reached the top. By the time Jane and Virginia arrived, the brothers were sitting on the edge of the outcropping, dangling their feet against the side. Virginia got upset when she saw them sitting there, terrified they would fall. "Charles, get off that edge! Mario, come on, you're scaring me!" pleaded Virginia. The brothers turned and grinned. "Oh, Virginia, we're okay. Remember, we used to climb to the top of the YMCA when it was under construction. And then this is safer than those steel girders," said Mario. "I know that story. You've always been crazy. Charles, please spread out the blanket, and let's get some lunch, Virginia retorted. Jane and Virginia emptied the basket, setting out the plates and silverware. Jane's mother had packed a bountiful basket of freshly fried chicken, deviled eggs, and potato salad. Bessie was a good cook, but Jane wished that she could have helped in the kitchen. It was hard to ignore the constant reminders that she couldn't do things that sighted women could. But she wasn't going to allow that thought ruin her day with Mario. This chicken is delicious, Jane. Your mother has really outdone herself, commented Mario. Virginia looked up at Jane, who grimaced and said, She likes to make it special for company. She has her own recipe, but she'll never teach me to do it. I might burn myself. If Mario had heard the sarcasm in her remark, he ignored it. And those deviled eggs are super. My mom never makes them, so the only time I get a deviled egg is when I come to visit you. Would anyone like some more lemonade? Virginia asked quickly. After stuffing themselves, Charles said, Jane and Mario, we're going for a walk. Do you want to go down and sit by the river for a while? Oh, sure, Mario replied. It will be good to get in the shade, and maybe we'll even dip our toes into the water. Charles helped the younger couple spread the old wool picnic blanket on the base of the towering rock and then said, We'll be back in a while. Okay, thanks, Charles. See you soon. Mario helped Jane get comfortably seated on the blanket and then sat down next to her. Drawing her closer to him, she rested her head on his shoulder and relaxed in the peaceful setting. Cicadas sang their loud mating calls from the trees, drowning out any bird song. The couple sat quietly as they listened to the sounds around them. Isn't it wonderful here, Jane? I can hear the water gurgling as it hits those rocks over there. It's quiet for a Sunday. I think we're the only ones here. It's nice of Charles and Virginia to give us some time for ourselves. I like being down closer to the river. The shade is nice. Oh, feel that breeze. It feels so good. I'll tell you what feels good. Holding your hand feels good. I miss you a lot, Mario. And I miss you, too. It won't be long now until I go to Notre Dame. I know, but I don't know how long I'll make it waiting 3 more years. That's a very long time. Indeed, but we just have to take it a day at a time. It will be over before you know it. And then can we get married? Don't forget, you still have to prove that you can earn a living. I know that you go to school, but earning a living is a bigger test. Jane, I'll do my best. I want more than anything to marry you and have a family. And I think that with Charles's help, I'll be able to convince you. I don't want you to live the rest of your life on the farm, but you'll have to be patient. I know that we'll make it. Mario sounded more confident than he felt. Both of their futures depended upon his ability to study, pass the bar, and make a living. Failure was unthinkable. Chapter 19. Law School Terrors. Mario climbed into his narrow dorm room bed and laid down with a heavy sigh. His muscles were tired but relaxed after swimming laps in the new gymnasium at Notre Dame. Every day he used an immense amount of mental energy, concentrating on complex legal terms, but swimming in the buoyant water rejuvenated him. He'd enjoyed feeling free in the water ever since his brother Charles had taught him to swim years before in the old gravel pit. Keeping physically fit was important to Mario. He was a firm believer in the power of exercise to balance the constant mental concentration that functioning as a blind person required. His brain was full of law cases that he'd studied that evening, and although he couldn't process any more complex information, his brain would not shut down. He had been in law school for 2 weeks, just long enough to realize the enormity of the challenge ahead of him. He tried to get comfortable, knowing that he needed to get enough sleep for the stressful day ahead of learning and memorizing complicated laws. He wondered if it was after midnight. There was no glass cover on his alarm clock, so he could feel the position of the hands and know the exact time, but he resisted reaching over. The 6 a.m. alarm would ring soon enough. It wouldn't help him to know that he had exactly 6 more hours of tossing and turning before starting all over again. The nightly torment began. Thoughts ran quickly through his head in the long, quiet hours. Mario could not afford to lose concentration during the day, but the familiar spiral of worry consumed every moment while resting. What if I'm not smart enough? How can I learn all that I need to know? What if I fail? What else can a blind man do for a living if this doesn't work? I don't want to make brooms or work at the newsstand at the courthouse. I know that some blind people do that, and I'm happy for them. But I can't make any money and support Jane doing that kind of work. And if I can't support her, she won't marry me. Then what will I do? I'll be a lonely blind man living with my parents. I don't know how I can keep up with the professors. They talk so fast, and writing Braille notes is slow and cumbersome. By the time I understand what they're saying and get it punched in on my slate, even with the shorthand I've developed, they've moved on to the next concept. Law vocabulary is full of multisyllabic words, and there's no way that I can listen to the professor, understand, and write it down without getting far behind in just a few minutes. God, I wish that I could take notes with a pen. Like everybody else. Mario felt his pulse quicken and a cold sweat began to seep from his pores. He turned over to his left side, trying to relax his muscles and stop the perspiration. Changing his position did not stop the thoughts marching through his brain. And the amount of reading outside of class that they expect me to do, there's just too much. My classmates complain about how much reading is assigned, but they can read it themselves. They don't have to wait for someone to come and read it to them. They can study whenever they want. I have to depend on the schedule of my 3 readers, and that frustrates the hell out of me. They're nice guys, and I couldn't go to school without them, but they must do their own studying first while I lose time waiting for them. And listening to someone reading aloud is always slow. Sometimes I think I will never get through the chapter, but at least I can type my notes as they read and keep up. They do enunciate clearly and willingly repeat a section when I asked. Thank God that Notre Dame pays for their services. I'm very grateful for that, since I don't have any money of my own. My dad works long 12-hour days at the candy store in Muncie to pay for my tuition. Mom helps there, too. What if I fail? They would have wasted all that money. They'd be so disappointed in me, especially after all the sacrifices they've made. I can't let Mom and Dad down. He tried to cheer himself up by thinking about Jane's letter that he had received the day before. His heart had skipped a beat when he reached into his narrow mailbox and found a thick envelope. It had to be from Jane. As he read and reread her letters, he could hear her voice saying the words. How he longed to talk over the telephone with her. It would be so comforting to hear her voice. But even if her family had a telephone, long distance was too expensive. Maybe I should try to study. Lying here isn't doing any good. Mario sat up, reached over to his nightstand, and found a thick folder. Opening it, he lay back, propped against his pillow, and began moving his fingers over the raised dots. Reading the intricacies of contract law failed to make him sleepy. He memorized each point and tried to guess what the professor might quiz the class on in a few hours. Finally, feeling drowsy, Mario put down the Braille papers and closed his eyes. I've got to get some sleep, he thought. He turned over onto his right side, breathed out a long sigh, and tried to relax, but thoughts of contracts and possible failure continued to float through his mind. The sound of his alarm clock ticking away seconds did not reassure him. Time was his enemy, pressuring him to stuff as much knowledge as possible into his brain. There was never enough time to master his classwork. Everything in his life took longer than for a sighted person. Every activity, from the time he got up until the time he fell exhausted into bed at night, required immense concentration. Getting himself dressed, shaved, and ready for the day took extra time as he reached for his clothes and hoped that he had no spots on his pants. His clothes, Braille books, and personal items were organized so he could remember where each was kept. Wasting time searching for something was extremely annoying. Sighted students could walk to class without paying attention, but he didn't but if he didn't concentrate and listen carefully for echoes while walking, he could easily get lost on the Notre Dame campus. How humiliating that would be. Mario flipped onto his back and began taking slow, deep breaths. Concentrating on his breathing finally helped him relax. He drifted into sleep, punctuated by nightmares of becoming disoriented on his way to an exam and failing because of his lapse. A chilly October breeze fluttered the curtains in Mario's dorm room, the only noise in the otherwise silent dorm. Friday nights in football season were usually quiet. The big game was Saturday afternoon, and the guys from the dorm were out celebrating in advance. Mario sat at his desk, listening to classical music on his radio, feeling alone and left out. He wished that he'd been invited out with his classmates, more for distraction than for the alcohol. He wasn't fond of weekends. They emphasized the loneliness and passed slowly, something that his side colleagues never could imagine. The next morning, he'd walk to the stadium with his tickets to the game. Notre Dame football tickets were coveted, so selling them was easy. Scalpers gave him $10, and he was happy to have some pocket money. It was impossible for him to follow the action without someone with him to describe the game. Listening to the play-by-play on the radio made it much easier to follow the action and to enjoy the game. Mario rose from his desk chair and walked four short steps to his bed. Lying down with his hands behind his head, he listened to Tchaikovsky's fourth movement of Symphony No. 6 as it played on his radio, the slow tempo and swelling strings deepening his melancholy. He thought of Jane and how she was probably sitting at that moment in her favorite chair and listening to a talking book recording. She was so patient to wait for him to finish law school. It seemed like they were always waiting, waiting for visits, waiting for letters, waiting for their lives to really begin. He wished he could share with Jane how anxious and overwhelmed he felt, but he didn't want her to worry. She'd think that I'm not going to make it through school. Then she will fear that she'll be stuck living forever with her parents on the farm and be a spinster with nothing much to do. She'd be doomed to sit in a chair, reading Braille magazines and listening to time pass as the grandfather clock ticked the seconds and chimed each quarter hour. She's so isolated on that farm, with nobody but her parents to talk to. What a horrible life that would be. I can't ruin her life by failing. I miss Jane so much. I wish I could see her every weekend. Just holding her hand would be wonderful. How I long to hear her voice. Mario sat up on the thin mattress and swung his feet to the ground. He might as well write Jane a letter and stop feeling sorry for himself. Sitting back down at his desk, he put a piece of thick paper into his Braille typewriter and began typing. Gradually becoming more confident as the semesters passed, Mario began to relax a little. He developed two close friends, which helped ease his loneliness. He enjoyed going to football games with them and discussing class homework assignments. He also joined the law student organization and participated in their activities. By his third year, Mario knew that he would complete his studies. His grades were excellent, and he looked forward to graduating. The next hurdle would be passing the Indiana bar exam that summer. If he failed, he could take it again the following year, but he was already 26, and their marriage would be delayed indefinitely since he would be wasting a year studying and not earning a living. With all the time and effort that he'd expended over the years, especially now that he was so close to convincing Jane that he could make a living and support her, failing the bar was unthinkable. And yet, if he did finish and pass the bar, Mario worried about how his blindness would be perceived to potential clients. He wondered who would want to hire a blind lawyer. He also considered the even more frightening thought that maybe he wouldn't be good enough to make money practicing law. Charles, who had moved back to Muncie, had asked him to join his practice. Mario knew that his brother would help him get established, but Charles could only do so much. If he couldn't prove to Jane that he could earn a living, she would not marry him. Mario graduated cum laude from Notre Dame in June of 1940 and was scheduled to sit for the bar exam in July. In some ways, his persistent worry pushed him to beat the odds, but his constant anxiety never faded. He knew that he would always have to work twice as hard as a sighted person. He had no choice. Chapter 20, Taking the Bar. Law school had been predictable. Classes followed a comfortable routine, and Mario knew what to expect each day. He took his tests with a portable typewriter, as he had done at Ball State. However, he was the first blind person to take the Indiana State Bar Examination and assumed that one of the five board members would read him the questions at the beginning of the session. He transcribed the questions into Braille, then typed the answers on his print typewriter. The first session of the exam was held at 8:30 a.m. on a hot July morning in a hotel in downtown Indianapolis. Mario came prepared with his portable typewriter, a pad of Braille paper, and his stylus and slate. The examiners met him when he arrived at the testing room. "Mr. Peroni, I'm John Williams, one of your examiners. I see that you've brought a lot of equipment." "Yes, sir, I have to be prepared." "Well, Mr. Peroni, you won't need all of that equipment. What we'll do is each board member will submit his set of questions to you, and you can take the examination orally." Mario was stunned. He was not prepared for an oral exam. His heart leapt, and he swallowed hard. It was one thing to demonstrate his ignorance privately on paper, but to face each examiner and to have to come up with the answers while they were watching him made the task seem impossible. Yet there was no option but to go along with the plan. "Oh, okay, where shall I go?" "Well, we have a room just down the hall." "May I take your elbow?" he asked while shifting the heavy typewriter to his other hand. "Yes, sure," said the man. "How do you want to do this?" "Just give me your left elbow, then I can walk with you," Mario said while extending his right hand in search of the man's elbow. He hoped the examiner wouldn't notice his shaking hand or hear his pounding heart. Mario and the examiner settled into the chairs facing each other. Although the tall hotel windows were open, it was stuffy in the small meeting room. The sound of passing traffic filtered in, and occasionally indistinct voices wafted in with the sultry breeze. Mario felt as if he were at the Grand Inquisition. If he failed, his life would be over. He tried to get comfortable in the hardwood chair. He wished he could have been treated like everyone else, but it was obvious that the examiners thought that they were doing him a big favor by allowing an oral exam. He took a deep breath in a vain attempt to slow his racing heart. "Mr. Peroni, as I mentioned before, my name is Mr. Williams. Are you ready?" He waited for Mario to nod his head and then said, "Here is your first question. Now take your time before you answer so that you're sure what you want to say." Mario could feel Williams' eyes boring into him while he desperately tried to figure out the answer. He took another deep breath, hoping to calm his thoughts. "I know the answer. I can do this." Finally, the words came to him. The questions continued all day with just a break for lunch. The same format occurred the next day, although each section had a different examiner. Mario could not tell how he was doing. He couldn't see the examiner's facial expressions. He received no clues from their monotone voices. Each sat sphinx-like, uttering no sounds and giving no indication of a response to his answers. At one point, Mario said, "So that is my answer, but I'm not confident about it." "That's your answer, is it?" was the first response from any one of the examiners, other than asking the questions. "Yes, but I expect that it's wrong." The examiner said nothing and went on to the next question. Mario was sure that he'd missed that one. The ordeal ended late in the afternoon on the second day. Mario finished about the same time as the others and stood in the hall, hoping to compare notes with his fellow examinees. "Mr. Peroni, we'd like to see you for a few minutes. Would you please join us?" asked Mr. Williams. "Oh, sure," replied Mario, not knowing why the examiners singled him out. "Oh my God, did I do so badly that they want to tell me right now to go home and give up law?" he worried. He followed the examiner back into the same room and braced himself. He was surprised when he heard three different voices greeting him in a friendly tone. It was the first time they'd shown any interest in him at all. "You know, Mr. Peroni, that we, of course, cannot tell you whether or not you passed. You'll get a notice about that in about 6 weeks. But would you like to know some of the answers to some of the questions?" "Oh, yes, thank you." As the examiners discussed a question from each section, Mario realized that the answers were the same as the ones he had given. His shoulder and neck muscles relaxed, and the overwhelming anxiety that had dogged him for years began to lift. Maybe he had passed after all. After thanking the examiners, Mario left the room and made his way downstairs to the lobby bar, where he knew the other students would gather after the exam. He was surprised to be warmly greeted by many and realized that somehow the word had already spread that Peroni knew the answers to the questions. "Hey, Mario, what was the answer to that question about the trustee distributing $10,000 cash?" asked one fellow who pressed a drink into his hand. Suddenly feeling very thirsty, Mario took a sip of a highball, cleared his throat, and began explaining his answer. While he was talking, he heard the shuffling of feet of others as they joined the crowd and felt the presence of others crowding around him to hear him. One question led to another, and he dutifully repeated the answers he told the examiners. Sometimes the group groaned, and sometimes they clapped, depending on whether their answers were the same as his. Mario began to feel important and enjoyed holding court with his colleagues. His drink never went dry, and by the end of the party, things began to get hazy. Later that evening, Mario went to a classmate's home to continue the celebration and enjoyed a period of great exhilaration. The next morning, he woke feeling hungover, but the relief and joy he felt far outweighed the physical discomfort. He was sure he had passed, but was still he had to wait weeks for the confirmation letter. Mario went back to Muncie for the summer to await the results and to prepare joining Charles in his law practice. The third week of August brought the letter from the State Board of Law Examiners of Indiana. He had passed the bar. Now Mario was ready to begin his career at the law firm of Peroni and Peroni. Most of his mental demons had been put to rest by graduating and passing the bar. But he still needed to prove that he could earn a living and support a family before Jane would marry him. They did not want to be charity cases. Enough people had already told them that two blind people shouldn't marry, that they couldn't take care of themselves, or that they would be unable to provide for a family. The naysayers didn't dissuade him. Mario was determined to prove to Jane, their families, and the world that he could be a good provider. Jane was equally determined to prove that she could run her own household and raise their children. With faith in his abilities and encouragement from Charles, he joined his brother and began the law firm of Peroni and Peroni on the top floor of the Johnson Building in downtown Muncie. Shortly after he began practicing, in September of 1940, a reporter from the Muncie Morning Star interviewed him. The article introduced the new lawyer and described him as having a most pleasing voice, distinct diction, and a dignified bearing. The fair-haired, eager-faced young lawyer was well over 6 feet tall. He speaks of his blindness with utter lack of false constraint, putting himself and others at ease. The complimentary article provided a big boost to his business as the phone started ringing with new clients. That article would be the first of many photos and clippings that his secretary kept in scrapbooks. Mario, the blind attorney, was a novelty in Muncie, and his press followed him closely. As a result, he felt great pressure to be well-groomed and always alert. He never knew when someone would be watching him. That person could be a reporter or simply a person on the street who would tell someone else a story about him. When Mario bought his first dictaphone, the company marketing department thought that he would make a great story to advertise their product. A company representative interviewed him and took a picture of him using the bulky machine. He could dictate letters and notes whenever he wanted, even when his secretary was busy. The dictaphone and his braille typewriter became indispensable tools. His secretary was available to read to him at almost any time, which was also invaluable. The frustrating days of waiting for a paid student reader were over. We have come to the end of the book hour and today's reading of The Sound of Her Voice by Mary Harper. The preceding program was a production of Sight into Sound Radio.